This is Leo Baybue for KTWH 99.5 FM, Two Harbors Community Radio. I am on the afternoon of Wednesday, August 12th. Fortunate enough to be able to join on the line with Kitty Mayo. Welcome to the airwaves, Kitty, for a little special look at COVID-19, schools, elections, and how these things all intertwine.
Great. Thanks, Leo, for having me on. One of my favorite topics.
Great. It's in your wheelhouse and you're actively researching, and we need to tap into those sources in the community. And I thought I'd try to begin with, we're on the cusp of a school board meeting on Wednesday evening in which don't know how many final decisions will be made, but they're likely to make at least an initial decision on the model for whether they're doing all in-person learning, a hybrid model with different grades or different times of the day, having different students in the building, or distance learning. Do you have a heads up through the community grapevine and to what is likely to be decided on tonight, by any chance?
Sure. Well, the last conversation I had with Bill Crandall, superintendent of Lake Superior School District, was almost a week ago. But at that time, the school board had been in some deep discussions already without making a final decision. And they had mostly been looking at surveys they'd been sending out to parents. They had gotten a good return already, not all of them. They were waiting to hear back from all parents of what parents wanted. So it's a little confusing when the governor announced the Minnesota Safe Learning Plan. It kind of leaves it up to each district and what's happening in their county within certain parameters. In Lake County right now, we fall within the safety parameters for bringing all the kids back full-time in person. Bill Crandall and the school board was interested in looking at what do parents want. And so far, last week when I spoke to him, he said almost a third of parents were not wanting to have their kids in person full time. So that was creating, you know, discussion of how are we going to do this exactly? Do we have some teachers who do not or cannot be back in school in person? The answer to that is yes. We have teachers with special circumstances where that wouldn't be safe for them. So looking at then how do you match those instructors to those students who are going to do online learning, and how do we bring the other kids back into the classrooms and do as much distancing as possible? So they had already talked about sending one class out at a time for recess instead of like the whole third grade, as we have been used to, that kind of thing. Trying to not have all the kids in the lunchroom at the same time of the, say, 75% or two-thirds or whatever it may boil down to that do end up back in school in person. It sounded to me like that was what was going to happen. Most kids are going to come back in person in the school district. Those parents who opted not to have their kids back in person could then do the online thing. It didn't look like to me they were leaning towards a hybrid. That's just my guess, though.
I think, though, that what in fact, if that survey result with up to a third of parents not wanting their children to do in person in the building learning, the safe school plan includes having to accommodate them fully with distance learning. So we have a de facto hybrid model in a way, because
indeed,
that's a lot of students who are going to have to be monitored doing distance learning as well as attending to those that are
absolutely
right there in the classroom. So I do not envy what these folks have to navigate here. And so whatever they decide tonight, they have really got their work cut out for them. And you and I were speaking before the interview about the fact that, of course, we now have teachers and a number of staff who are essential workers who we're going to want to keep tabs on our population and whether or not there's a COVID exposure or a case of COVID. And how do you read what we face in terms of trying to keep all the personnel safe and identified when somebody has contracted COVID-19?
How is
that
going to...
Yeah.
One of the things that they're trying to hammer out is how are we screening for COVID, and then what is our protocol, you know, once we have a teacher or staff person or a student. And of course, they'll follow the MDH guidelines, which mirror the CDC guidelines, which is a 14-day isolation of somebody with COVID-like symptoms. What we'd love to do is test everybody, get back a negative or positive, know what we're dealing with, and proceed from there. Send the kid back to school, and the teacher come back to school if they don't have COVID. Unfortunately, there is such a shortage of tests right now that that's just not a reality. So unfortunately, I think most people that present symptoms are going to be asked to quarantine for 14 days. Unfortunately, in that, that's going to take a lot of staff and kids out of school because these symptoms are kind of broad. and they can mean a lot of different things. So we'll have to take a broad approach of protecting everyone. I believe that's what the school board will have to do. I want to mention taking of temperatures is going to be used as a screening tool, and it has in a lot of other settings as well. However, there's a real failure for the taking of temperatures to really be an appropriate screen for COVID. Most people don't have a temperature when they're infectious. Even people being admitted to ICUs for COVID treatment, only 30% of those people have a fever.
That certainly was the buzz in early days in March and April, was that we were looking at elevated temperatures, anything over 100.3. And I had the impression that it was a much higher percentage of cases presenting. And you're saying we've learned a lot, and that's not
it. We've learned a lot. And I think it's important for us not to have a false sense of security that if we don't have a fever, then we're safe. There's a almost definite in the research that at least 30% of people that are actively infectious don't have any symptoms, let alone a fever. So a lot of leeway there. But I think we're going to look at staff shortages at the schools, because I don't think people who aren't feeling well, they're going to have to go home. They're not necessarily going to be able to get a COVID test to clear them to come back for another 14 days.
Now, wouldn't we prefer to have at least a test taken early on when symptoms present and then be able to test again before they would re-enter a building where they'd have direct physical contact to look for a negative COVID test or two before they're back in duty with, you know, in rather close contact with their students and or other staff?
That would be ideal for sure. As far as what I can tell, unless some miracle happens, testing supplies are just not at a level that that's going to be allowable. Even at Lakeview Clinic and Hospital, their non-critical, non-medical staff, if they are currently presenting with symptoms, don't necessarily get a test before returning to work. They're using that 14-day isolation as the clearing of any symptoms or infectious opportunity to keep everyone safe. So even at that level, if you have a staff that isn't a doctor or a nurse or somebody who's interacting directly with patients, so if there aren't enough tests to handle that capacity right now, I doubt that teachers are going to necessarily be able to have access to getting tested.
Yeah.
The MDH has really lowered their standard. They had, really best practices would be testing as many people as possible all the time, right? That would really have an effect on containing the virus. And they had kept expanding and expanding, testing even people who did not have symptoms but had contact with someone who tested positive.
Yeah.
They've lowered that. That is no longer the case. There's not enough tests for that to go around. Even kids that are trying to go to college that need a COVID test before they'll be admitted to college, not in Lake County, there's not enough tests here for that.
Did this arise by us underestimating what the capacity, the quantity of reagents, tests, and lab turnaround that we would need? There was the moonshot of 20,000 tests a day that the governor aimed for back 3 months ago. And then we got up into the upper teens of thousands, 15,000 to 20,000 tests, but yet we still couldn't keep up and get contact tracing because we couldn't get those tests even returned fast enough, never mind whether they were adequate in number. So this has been an elusive goal.
It's been a very elusive goal. Exactly where the bottlenecks are, I can't tell you for sure. It's baffling to me. It's got to be a supply-demand kind of thing, and there's a million possibilities of dead ends along the way, I guess. Right now, it's not tests that are so much a shortage. It's the medium and the swabs that are at a shortage. So it's a real funny thing. It's not even that technical. These are not, the medium is not a complicated chemistry. The swabs are, they're sticks. Some of them have little cotton things on the end. It depends on which tests they're doing. But of course, they have to be prepared and packaged and, you know, sanitized. They have to be the right ones. So this is not high-tech stuff, though, that we're having a shortage
But Kitty, could we unpack a little bit? Is anywhere in the state, for instance, where numbers of new cases are presenting still much higher, are they getting more allocation of resources? Is this kind of triage and Greg Ruberg at Lakeview has to take what he can get based on the number of cases?
Yeah, there's truth in that. Some of his allocations are based on the number of tests he's done in the previous week. So if he lowers the amount of testing he's doing, he'll get less tests the next week. It's kind of,
he's being told that.
But you're right.
Yeah, so he could run out of supplies by just testing to try to get more testing ingredient sent. It's a bizarre incentive. Okay.
It's a bizarre incentive. You're absolutely right about that. So, yes, there is a triage factor there. We are running a lot of tests in Minnesota, but you hit on something really important that I want to point out. The return time on test results right now is right around 4 days, and we're calling that good because a couple of weeks ago, it was taking 7, 8, maybe even 10 days for
yes.
results. Those results are practically worthless.
Yes.
At 4 days.
I was just amazed. The person could be on the mend and ready to return when they're finding out, oh, yeah, I had COVID.
Mm-hmm. And the most infectious point is early on,
yeah.
even before symptoms
right.
for most people. But nonetheless, the most accurate test is about 8 days after you are exposed or infected. So there's a lot of numbers to play with there. But that 48-hour turnaround is really the golden rule. So I wanted to talk a little bit about contact tracing.
Oh, yes, please do.
Issue that I've been really interested in. So contact tracing is the idea you go for a test, you get a positive test, somebody's going to contact you from public health and ask you, well, are you okay and can we help and give you some advice. And also, please recommend, not require, but recommend that you self-quarantine for 14 days from the first day of the positive test or the first day of your symptoms if that test came later. And then they're going to ask you to divulge your close contacts, people that you've been within 6 feet of for 15 minutes or more. And they're going to ask if you'll give them phone numbers of the people that have met that criteria. Then they're going to call those people and tell them that they've been exposed to someone who has now tested positive with COVID. So this is the contact tracing. It's a really well-rehearsed and well-understood way to contain a virus, because if you can reach those people that are most likely to have been infected, ask them to quarantine. If they do that, you can really start to contain this and slow it down, and a lot fewer people get sick. But you have to be able to reach those contacts within 48 hours of the first this case was positive. So if we're not getting results back for 4 days and then asking for contacts, it's practically pointless. Now, I'm just going to throw out there Dr. Michael Osterholm. I don't know if you know that name.
Indeed.
He's kind of...
Minnesota, the pride of Minnesota's infectious disease specialist.
Indeed, yeah, for the Center of Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. And the point, I follow him really closely. He's always being interviewed. He's doing podcasts. He's on YouTube. He does TED. You can always find him talking somewhere, and he's doing frequent updates. And it's a really good resource if listeners want to try and tap into that. What he's saying right now is we cannot contain this with contact tracing anyways. And one of the main reasons is our test results are taking too long. So by the time we get that result and we try to contact trace, that person has already had many more contacts that are potentially infected.
I need to break here, Kitty, just to let folks know, I didn't even properly introduce you as local freelance investigative reporter Kitty Mayo, whose articles you may see in the North Shore Journal and elsewhere, like Business North in the past and in the future, I suppose. And I am Leo for KTWH Radio, and we are talking about all the wrinkles attendant to trying to be back in action with schools returning, with people in-person learning, elections coming up, and the fact that contact tracing is now, as Kitty is pointing out, that Dr. Michael Osterholm has pointed out as well, is problematic. So are the contact tracers for the state of Minnesota still conducting contact tracing even when it's ineffectual? I'm sorry,
they
that
are.
Seems like an odd question to frame it that way.
They are, and they're failing miserably even at that.
Okay.
So I'm sorry to have so much bad news. Contact tracing in Minnesota is less than 30%. Even like whenever the results do come in, whether it's 4 days or a week, only 30% about of contacts are being actually contacted. Not enough to contain anything.
Wow.
Not even helpful. Mm-hmm. So that's a problem. Minnesota says that it has enough contact tracers. The state Minnesota Department of Health says, we have enough. We've got about 800 and some. That's the right amount. George Washington University has a formula that would suggest we need more of like 3,000 contact tracers with the current caseload that we have. St. Louis County, you know, it's blowing up.
Yes.
Right? It's in the top six fastest growing number of cases per capita right now. We're up to 22 cases in Lake County.
It's
going to blow up here real soon.
I just keep looking every day to see if it's going up by more than one because, you know, I live on the border of the two counties and the county that I'm driving from to visit with you today is blowing up, but I'm driving to a place that's people are saying is quiet. Well, what do you propose we should expect to see?
Well, I think it's going to rapidly show up in Lake County the way it has in St. Louis County. We were matching them almost exactly. Lake County was slightly less infection rate than St. Louis County, but on par. Very close. So
yes.
I expect, you always see a little bit of a lag. I expect we're going to see the same thing. In Lake County, the biggest growth that we've seen out of the 22 cases in Lake County, 14 of those 22 are in that 20 to 29 age range. We're in trouble here. This is a lot of younger people who then will go on to expose older people and more at-risk health people. And then I have to throw this caveat in here. People need to understand children are still at risk, even
yes.
if they are slightly less infectious, is what the current research is looking like. They can still get very sick, and they can make other people very sick.
And I would like to roll it back then to the concept that if Lake County is going to see a significant uptick and we're back in person educating in Lake County at three different school sites in 3 weeks. Sounds like between both the adults who we know a lot about their infectivity and the people who are more sensitive to being more deeply affected to the point of hospitalization, we've just got a real quagmire could develop. Will we expect that we may see the school district needing to make kind of emergency dial back decisions? Is that something that you would
I'm totally cool on speculating. A lot of this is speculation. It has been right
along.
Let's
couch it that way to everyone. We're speculating based upon logic and experiences everywhere else.
I can't guarantee it, but I can almost, I would put a bet on it that Lake County School District will have to change its course midstream at some point when the cases accelerate beyond a certain point, either because staffing just isn't enough to support in person or because we breach that 10 cases per 10,000 people in a rolling 14-day average.
Right.
Yeah, it's coming. I think every official that I have talked to has indicated to me they are preparing for a doubling and tripling of cases in the fall and winter, and have a lot of concern about how we're going to manage that it's likely to get quite ugly.
And remember, we spoke before about the fact that under the plan as constructed for the whole state, every parent who makes the decision to bring their child back home for distance learning adds another child who won't be there won't be sufficient numbers in the classroom to even justify having the in-person learning again.
Yes.
So even if they wanted to hold out for it, it just wouldn't make sense at some point.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I feel like I want to say here that the clock is ticking on us to be able to do any number suppression in Lake County and to take any sort of moves that would be protective before, across the country, this is well known amongst experts, epidemiologists, scientists of all stripes. We're running out of time because indoor air.
Yes.
Is bad for transmission of COVID. And there's a lot of reasons why, but basically we breathe in more of other people's air when we're indoors. And that hasn't really been looked at in Minnesota with, you know, we hear in the news there's an outbreak based out of a restaurant or a bar or some other indoor visiting. And we hear about it in the news, yet these facilities remain open and now we're opening schools. So I think we can really predict pretty definitely what's going to happen.
Well, if you had any benign dictatorship powers, is there anything that you would intercede to do, Kitty, to change that scenario? What could possibly be done except another kind of stay-at-home order? And we're not really hearing much support for that.
I don't think that it would actually be necessary. I think some of the hot spots we're looking at really are bars and restaurants, places where people are indoors for 15 minutes or more within 6 feet of other people without their mask on. Add a little alcohol, stir, inhibitions fall away. I think there's a real clear-cut answer to some moves we could make, which is difficult in, you know, certain people's businesses and could be, you know, cause hardships, but I believe would make a real difference in in the transmission, it seems pretty apparent by where some of the spread has been happening.
Well, certainly the schools will be taking as many precautions as they can, so it will not be analogous to what you're talking about in bars and restaurants, but yet the number of people, it's one of the most dense accumulations of human populations in our otherwise rural county, isn't our, mm-hmm. our school operations, from the buses in the morning through mm-hmm. school lunches and classrooms.
Absolutely.
It's a tough one.
It's a tough one. With children, if you can keep their masks on, you're going to have one part of the battle right there. And I think you'll have some success with that, depending on the age of the kids. The other thing to look at would be ventilation. And there's only been some research starting to be done on this, but it's not being talked about very much, and I'm very surprised because it appears to have a pretty massive effect on the transmission of the virus in indoor settings. And it seems to me like a nut that could be cracked. I think it's a science, ventilation. I don't know much about it,
yes.
but how air moves around and how it's filtered, I would think we could figure some of this out.
It's rather personal to us who work at a station that has virtually no ventilation. And because of that, we've taken really strict steps to have people in separate rooms, not sharing air. But we all know that air mm-hmm. has to get around somehow, or you kind of run mm-hmm. out of oxygen. Mm-hmm. I think, Kitty, unfortunately, I'm going to have to end with our look at contact tracing in schools and where, you know, how Lake County is liable to see upticks in COVID-19 soon, and maybe talk about elections and how that's going to play out in another interview down the road here with you. I would really like to visit with you again about that.
Okay, sounds great.
Well, thank you so much, Kitty Mayo, for joining us today. I know you'll be on the air also talking about stories in the North Shore Journal this week with Tom Kohler. Thanks a lot for visiting with us today, and we'll catch you next time, and we'll talk about what's going to happen in November.
Sounds good. Thanks, Leo.
Thank you, Kitty. Bye now. That was Kitty Mayo, investigative freelance journalist. We're talking COVID-19 and all of the fallout, and making some predictions and speculations about where it's headed as we head into the school year and the fall and winter indoor season. You're listening to KTWH.